And taking a seat. Okay, my name is Loy Jones. I'm taking the place of the clerk for tonight, Ellen McCambly. Ellen is in traffic on the Garden State Parkway. She will be here for the rest of the sessions starting tomorrow. Maybe she'll even come in later tonight. Welcome to everybody. Really glad to see you. We are very happy that you have chosen this conference. This conference is over 60 years old. It has been going on with all these people who have been interested both in the psychology of Carl Jung and in Quaker practice. Many people belong to meetings, Quaker meetings. Many people do not. We certainly welcome everybody. You will notice there's a color code system. First of all, people with blue dots are new to the conference. And so we would ask you to stand up in unison right now. You don't have to give us our names, but just stand so we can welcome you. We hope you have a wonderful time and come back year after year after year. I'll explain about the red dots a little bit later. First, Ellen tells me I have to do some housekeeping duties, like telling you where the bathrooms are. If you haven't found them already, they are on this floor, and if you go down the stairs, you can also find a men's room and a ladies' room down at the bottom of the stairs. We ask that cell phones please be turned off, even at a vibrating mode, if you can turn them off, out of courtesy not only to the plenary speaker but also to your workshop leaders, and certainly during meeting for worship. There are some announcements about people who are not with us tonight. Dirk and Perry and Frank and Peggy were in an automobile accident in North Carolina. Now, they are okay. Frank has a limp, he told me on the phone, and Peggy twisted her hip. Dirk and Perry are okay. The car was totaled. I've been to visit with Lucy Ettinger, who for the second time in a very short period of time has had a problem falling in her apartment, and she, as she told me, she cracked her hip. Surgery is probably not an option. She is in a rehab home in Baltimore. I will put on the message board the telephone number, and if I can get the address of the home, I will let you know that. Yes. Yes, she is one of our elders. She was the registrar for a period of time before Dick. And she's just a great lady, and I'm sure she would appreciate calls or cards, that sort of thing. She's very interested in the conference. She has wanted to know what the workshops are and about the plenary speaker, and she's just right there with us. So if you will hold those people in the light, give them calls, send them cards if you can. The message board will be opposite the registrar. And on that, you can put your messages to people in the conference. If you need a ride home, if you have space in your car, that kind of thing. And also telephone numbers. Now, about the other color code, the people with the red dots, please stand up. These... These are the planning committee people. We meet several times a year to bring this all together, spend a lot of time on the telephone and emailing and in order to have the conference for you. People with red borders are your listeners, and can you stand up? Okay. Yes, you. There are a couple more coming. Joanne. Oh, I'm sorry. And I think Joanne has a red border, right? Yeah, she has a red border. And these are listeners. And if you are having any problems at the conference, or you just want to talk to someone about your workshop or anything else, seek these people out, and they've been designated to help you. Dana and Queenie, stand up, please. Francis. They are going to have a table for newcomers. They want to especially welcome you, and it's going to be in the tomorrow at lunch. It will be tomorrow at lunch, so you can meet each other and find out more about the conference at the time. We have a bookstore, which is in the library area, directly behind the stairs. It's on this floor, behind the stairs. And we have books for sale from the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting Library. We also have a lending library. And this will be closed during plenary sessions and also during workshop sessions. However, you can get in there and buy a book up until 9:30 at night. We have a very nice man, Jeremy. I guess he's out there now. Oh, stand up, Jeremy. Yes, right. And he will help you. tonight. He also brings all those books from Philadelphia. That's no easy job. Yeah. Packs them up and takes them back again. We invite you to enjoy contra dancing or dancing in the pit, which is down the stairs. The contra dancing you probably are familiar with. And the dancing in the pit is for those people who want to just dance off steam. It's a great deal of fun, okay? This will be Saturday night. Sunday night, we have a talent show. If you would like to sign up to be in the talent show, there'll be a list over on the where the messages are. So I think what we will do now is to just have a few minutes of silence, and then Dick will introduce our speaker.
I think most of you have, I hope you most of you have looked at Jeff's website, Jeff Kripal's website, and have read what we've sent out about Jeff. So I won't spend much time with going over his credentials, which are rather impressive. But I do want just a few minutes to tell you a story about how he's come to be here. Way back in my youth, I spent a very, very life-changing week at Esalen. And that memory of that week and what's transpired since has been with me since till today. About 2 years ago, I found Jeff's book on the history of Esalen. And as I read the book, I more and more felt as if Jeff was telling my story and probably a great many other people's stories who were also spent time at that marvelous place. The minute I finished that book, I realized I have to get a hold of this fellow. Well, how do you do that? In the old days, try to find an author, you write a letter to the publisher and hope maybe you'll get it. Today it's easy. Go on the internet and Google his name and there he is, complete with an email address. So I emailed him and told him how impressed I was with the book and how I had some archival material that he might be interested in. And the next thing I get an email back, give me a telephone call. Let's talk. And we started a conversation, and of course, in the course of a conversation, as a lot of you know, FCRP has become my middle name. And so I told him about the conference and told him who we were a little bit and asked him would he perhaps be interested in being our speaker. Well, he jumped at it. He said, great. And so after a bit of back and forth on what would he talk about and how would it work, we came up with the topic of these sessions that Jeff is going to give us this weekend. And we've met with him at Pendle Hill in January, and all of us on the planning committee were as impressed with him as I was the first time I encountered him. So I will not take up any more of Jeff's precious time, but I'd like to introduce our speaker, Jeff Kribel.
Thanks. Great. Can you all hear me? Is the mic okay? Okay, great. Thank you, Dick, for that wonderful introduction. I want to thank the selection committee that made the horrible mistake of inviting me here this year. I really appreciate it. I was honored to come. I've sort of followed the Quakers for years, didn't know much about them, so it was a pleasure to come to Pendle Hill in January and meet you all. I also want to thank C. Kaplan, who picked me up at 2:30 this morning, or 1:45 this morning. We didn't get to the hotel till 2:30. I didn't get to bed till 4. That's why I'm sitting here rather than standing. But C. was a champ to pick me up that late. And something very strange happened to me on my trip here that I want to begin with. It actually involves both Dick and C, and it also involves Jung, believe it or not. Jung was very close to a quantum physicist by the name of Wolfgang Pauli. And Pauli had the curious habit of whenever he would walk into a physics laboratory, something would fizzle or blow up. And this was quite famous among physicists in Europe. In fact, some of the physicists wouldn't let Wolfgang in their laboratory. And I recently was at, actually it was a Unitarian church, and I was talking about this, and afterwards an elderly Jewish physicist came up to me and told me about the conference he was at with Pauli, where they actually made Pauli sit on the opposite end of the air conditioner in the room. So this was a real thing. And it was out of these experiences that Jung and Pauli developed this notion of synchronicity, which I think many of you are probably familiar with. A synchronicity is basically an experience one has in which the external environment seems to be linked deeply to one's own subjective state of mind. In other words, something's happening in the world that's also happening in your soul or in your psyche, And we don't really have any way of explaining that because there's obviously no causal connection. And so Jung and Pauli called this a synchronicity. And yesterday, I had a very strange synchronicity that involved these two men, Dick and C. When I had been at Esalen for 2 weeks helping direct two different symposia. This was the place Dick spoke about. I go out there about 3 times a year. And I was there for 2 weeks. It's in Big Sur. It's on a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean. So yesterday I got up and left. I could have spit into the Pacific Ocean. I was so close to it. I was in a house overlooking it. I left Big Sur at 7 o'clock. And on my way to the airport, which was 3.5 hours away, one of the first things I saw on the road, Highway 1, was a fox. Now, I have never seen a wild fox, I don't think, in my entire life. So I was very struck by this, and I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And I didn't think much of it. And then C picked me up late last night, and we were driving to Chesterbrook, and wouldn't you know it, another fox came out of the forest and ran right by or right to the side of our car. So I literally saw a fox. I've never seen a fox in my life. And yesterday I saw two of them, one at the beginning of my trip from Esalen and the other to my trip here with the Quakers, who were, of course, founded by a man named George Fox. So that's actually not a joke. That all happened. And you can make of that what you want. I found it very delightful. So that's a way of introducing myself. I want to say a bit tonight. The goal of tonight is not to lecture at you or to you. It's to really tell you about myself, not to sound like a resume, but to kind of create a safe space where we can explore a lot of topics that are not usually talked about. The psychology of religion is famous for its complete ignoral of taboos. You talk about things you're not supposed to talk about, and you do it as honestly and as clearly as you can. And so my experience teaching these subjects is the more quickly you can create a safe space, the more effectively you can begin that conversation. So that's what I want to do tonight, is tell you a bit about these four lectures and about my own life and why I've really spent my entire adult life trying to figure out things that are not supposed to have answers. I also want to say that my teaching style is essentially looking for the foxes. It's looking for those moments that happen between people that require you to look and to take coincidences and signs seriously. I'm also a big believer in humor. So if you feel like laughing at something, please laugh, even if it's not a joke. It can become one. One of my inspirations here is John Cleese. John is a friend of Esalen, believe it or not. And a couple years ago, we were at a fundraiser together, and John gave a stand-up routine that changed my life, and I'll explain how. I'm not going to repeat what he said or try to replicate it because I'm not John Cleese, obviously. But the theme of the routine was that what wisdom is that when you get to a certain point in life and you realize that nobody knows what they're doing. And, wow, when I heard that, I was like, oh, my God, that is so true. And a few weeks later, I was at my university, which is Rice University in Houston, Texas, and I was on this undergraduate curriculum committee, which basically means we were trying to figure out what to teach 18, 19, and 19-year-olds. And I was listening to everybody talk, and I was thinking to myself, we really have no idea what we're doing. And so Cleese came back to me, and he always comes back to me. And the reason that's so important is it's liberating. Once you realize that, then your own incompetence doesn't look like it's so bad. So just keep that in mind. If you think I'm incompetent, just remember, please, okay? All right, so what these four lectures are about, I talked at length with the selection committee in January. I've been talking to Dick for about a year, and we were looking for a theme that would tie a lot of things together. And I proposed this theme of American religious history and democracy, and trying to uncover another way of thinking about American religious history that isn't about the denominations or evangelical Christianity, which is usually how it's talked about. So what I'm going to be interested in here are some submerged but very old and very well-established spiritual traditions that emphasize the soul or the psyche's direct relationship to the sacred without mediation and without any institution standing between it. So really what we're going to be talking about is the relationship between the psyche and the sacred, which is the subject of the psychology of religion. That's what the psychology of religion is all about. That's what Jung was all about. And that's what these four lectures will be all about. That's tricky, though. It's very tricky. For one thing, nobody really knows what the psyche is. Nobody really knows what the sacred is. And everybody disagrees on how those two things are related. So that's really what the history of religion is a whole series of takes on what the psyche is, what the sacred is, and how are they related or not related. And so that's sort of the space we're going to be entering here. It's also worth saying that psyche, of course, is a Greek word. It's usually translated self or mind, but it literally means soul. So already we're in this space where, you know, what is the mind? What is consciousness? And I can tell you that the standard view in academic psychology today is that there is no psyche. No, there really isn't. That's what they say. Neuroscience claims that the psyche is essentially an epiphenomenon or a kind of surface product of billions of cells firing in certain orders and creating the illusion of self or the illusion of psyche, but there really is no such thing. And so when the brain dies, of course, the psyche blips out. That's the standard view. So we're not going to be taking that view. That was not the view of Jung. The other view is that, of course, what we'll call the filter thesis, which is that the brain is an incredibly sophisticated filter or transmitter of consciousness, but that it does not produce consciousness. It's rather like a television set that picks up these channels and projects them. But when you destroy your television set, Simon Cowell doesn't die, right? He's still there, and he's being transmitted from somewhere else. So we're going to kind of be bouncing back and forth between these two models. The history of religions, which is really the area that I know the most about, is filled with different models of what the psyche is and what the sacred is. And I just might mention here three individuals right off the bat who are offered very different models. One is, of course, George Fox, the founder of the Quakers, who spoke about the light and its direct relationship to the divine without mediation. Another man who did the same is Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom I'll be talking about tomorrow. Emerson was a Unitarian minister outside of Boston who wrote about the oversoul. And again, this notion of this direct relationship to the transcendent, and so founded something called Transcendentalism, which we'll get to tomorrow again. And the third man is Carl Jung, whom we'll be returning to as well. Jung spoke about the ego, which is this conscious self that we're all in right now, or at least I'm in. This is our social identity that's formed over years and decades through child-rearing practices and culture and language and belief and really everything that happens to us. But for Jung and his colleagues, this is not what the psyche is in toto. There's this unconscious that surrounds that ego, and then there's something called the collective unconscious, which is a kind of global mind or a world soul that links all human beings and all cultures and times in a kind of global mind. And in individuals in whom all those levels are coordinated in some way, he talked about the self, which he capitalized. The self is not the ego. The self is not the unconscious or collective unconscious. It's all three levels sort of working in harmony. And so Jung had a very distinct notion of this. Jung also had a very, very profound interest in what we might call the occult, or what is called the paranormal today. His dissertation actually was on occultism. And he wrote the dissertation on a medium who, it turns out, was his cousin. And he spent his entire life involved in these issues. At one point, his house was haunted by a kind of poltergeist phenomenon. He channeled a text called The Seven Sermons to the Dead. And towards the end of his life, he wrote a very significant book about UFOs in 1958, in which he read UFOs as sort of planetary poltergeists. So we'll return to all these issues on Monday. But I just want to signal all that for you. These are all, I think, part of this relationship between the psyche and the sacred. Today people speak in terms of two categories that, again, I don't want to dwell on tonight, but we'll get to tomorrow. One is mysticism and the other is spirituality. And these two terms are used very loosely, but they have very distinct histories and, I think, fairly clear definitions. Mysticism comes from the Greek mystikos for secret. So mysticism is literally secretism. And it usually refers to some direct union with the divine that the soul has. Spirituality is a term that comes, of course, from the word spirit or spiritus, which means spirit. And believe it or not, it doesn't go any further back than the middle of the 19th century. It's a very modern term. The first occurrence we can find in which it's used in its modern sense is in Walt Whitman, which is really interesting. Of course, people talked about the spiritual before the middle of the 19th century, but not in the terms that people use it today. They meant something very different by it. So we'll be talking about all of that. Also, I'll be talking quite a bit about the relationship between democracy and these submerged traditions. And I'll be saying some things that I think may not make much sense on first hearing or first glance, but I think if you think about them, they'll make more sense. And my basic point here is that our religious traditions really assume a kind of monarchy. We sort of live in spiritual monarchies, even though we live in political democracies. And what I mean by that is God is still referred to as a king or a lord in the sky. People kneel. They bow down. These are all gestures that servants use to address kings in the ancient world. So there's a kind of political submission built into our religious worldviews that I think is at serious odds with our democratic values. And I'd like us to just think about that and see what that might mean. In terms of the four lectures, tonight's lecture is called Secrets in the Seats, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a little bit. It's really about setting the mood or a relationship between you all and me and helping to, again, create this safe space. And it's also about something I want to call the psychological turn, which happened in the late 19th, early 20th century, and which people like Freud and Jung really pioneered. And it really changes completely, I think, the way we think about religion today. And so there's one thing I want you to take away from tonight. It's some grasp of what we mean by the psychological turn. And I'll explain that later. The psychological turn. Tomorrow's lecture is called The Free Spirit and the Third Way. And here I'm going to kind of paint a big canvas for you of this total history of these alternative religious movements that emphasize the individual and the freedom of the individual soul. And I'm going to focus in, not exclusively, but just as a way of talking about the issues, on the tradition that Dick spoke of and that I just came from, that is the Esalen Institute. Not on the Institute itself, but on the broader movements that have sort of really flowed through American culture over the last 60 years, and I think have really formed us, or formed many, many Americans. And so I want to kind of get a handle on that. And there'll be a nice slideshow, by the way, for that, a professional one. And by professional, I mean I didn't do it. It looks really good, which means, again, I didn't do it. Sunday's lecture is called On Spirit and Sex. And here I'm going to focus in. So tomorrow's about the big picture, the big historical canvas. And then on Sunday and Monday, we're going to focus in on different issues and where sort of the rubber meets the road on these traditions. So Sunday's on spirit and sex, and we're going to look at the issue of gender, the issue of sexuality, and again, how this has played out in different world religions and has sort of, in a way, come to a climax or a head in the last 50 or 60 years. Forgive the pun, I didn't mean that. See, he laughed. That wasn't meant as a joke. Somebody laughed. I hope we can laugh Sunday. It's a serious lecture, but it's also, I hope, a funny one. And then Monday, the lecture is called The Book of Miracles, and it's on the paranormal stuff. The two foxes that I just told you. It's not going to be about the two foxes, but it's going to be about events like that. I just published a book called Authors of the Impossible, which is all about the paranormal, and we're working on a film as well. A film company optioned it. So I want to show you a 12-minute film cut of the film and get us talking about the really weird stuff that I think happens to all of us, and that we don't have a way of addressing or sometimes even admitting. And so I'd like us to talk about that. Okay, so does that look okay in terms of a... yeah, please. In the seats. Secrets in the seats. Yeah, the seats. In other words, you're the secrets. Okay, so that's where we're at now. I want to talk about that title. So tonight I want to talk about the secrets in the seats, and in other words, I want to talk about you. I know nothing about you, but I'm going to talk about you. Because my guess is you're a lot like all the other people I've talked to over the last 20 years, in the sense that you're a secret to yourself. There's a lot about you that you don't understand. And there's a lot about me that I don't understand. And so that means there's a lot between us that we really don't understand. And one of the things that happens when I teach, my day job, I'm a professor at Rice University. I teach young people. And I teach young people how to think critically and sympathetically about religion, which is a very, very difficult and satisfying and exciting thing to do. And the reason it's so difficult is because, unlike all my other colleagues in the university, in history or sociology or mathematics or biology, these kids have all studied all that stuff. They've taken courses in biology and history and political science in high school. Virtually no one has studied religion in high school. No one. So, but they've encountered religion, in their churches and synagogues and religious communities. And what that means is they think I'm a priest or a minister. And they think the Department of Religious Studies is where you go to hear about how to get your beliefs confirmed or strengthened. That's a serious mistake, by the way. And so what we do in a classroom is, this is what Freud called transferences. Do you know what a transference is? Right. A transference is when, it's usually used in a therapy session, a transference is when the patient treats the analyst as if he or she was a figure from their past. So the analyst becomes the father or the mother or the sister or whatever the person has the most trouble with, and the patient projects all of that stuff onto the therapist. And Freud's point was that if you're not aware of that, you can't get anywhere. But if you're aware of that, it's very powerful because you can then make aware what those issues are and you can move beyond all that stuff and get beyond. And that's exactly what happens in a college classroom. The kids come in and they're transferring all sort of crap onto me. And so what I do in the first couple classes is I try to get them to own up to those transferences and to show them that I'm not their minister or priest or father or mother or whatever their transference is. Once they understand that, then that safe space is created and they sort of light up and you can have a 4-month conversation with them about the most interesting and meaningful and often troubling parts of their lives. And that's a very powerful space to be in because it doesn't exist anywhere else in our culture. There's nowhere else I'm aware of where that work can happen. And so that's really what I want to do tonight. Look, we don't have 4 months. We have 4 days. So we got to move quickly here. So tonight I want to tell you a bit about myself, where I'm coming from. I want you to think about your own transferences. Who do you think I am? What do you think this weekend was about? And I want you to let that all go. And I want you to just listen to what I have to say, think about it, and I hope we can have conversations then over the next 4 days. Okay, so that's my goal. So I want to begin then with this notion of the psychological turn. And parts of this lecture, little parts of it, I want to read to you because this is where it gets technical. But they're not long. But these are the parts that are really important for us to get down. So here's what the psychological turn is. By this phrase, we mean the insight that what earlier cultures and peoples understood. Yeah. The psychological turn. T-U-R-N. Okay? And what we mean by this is what earlier cultures and peoples thought of as outside them, gods or goddesses or spirits or creation stories, that after Freud and Jung and the psychology of religion, we now read those things as about the psyche. So this is classical Jung. Creation myths really aren't about the creation of the universe. They're about the structure of the psyche. Okay? The God or the spirit may be out there, but it's always reflected through the culture and the psyche of the individual experiencing that God or that spirit. And so this is a very subtle move. It doesn't mean that nothing's out there. It doesn't mean there is no God. But it means that that God or that spirit or that totem is always experienced through the culture and the psyche of the one having it. Now, why is that important? Because once you make that move, you can then study any religious system both critically and sympathetically. if you believe that one religious system is the correct one and all the others are wrong, then you can't study religion. It makes no sense. Why would you do that? It's pointless. But if you see all human religious experience as a manifestation of the human psyche and its relationship to the sacred, then all human religious experience becomes meaningful, but no single system can be privileged. You see that? Again, I'm not asking you to make that move, but I want you to understand that move. That's the move that the psychology of religion made 100 years ago. And that's why it's so powerful, because it allows us to be sympathetic and critical at the same time. Okay? And that's really important to understand. Okay. I want to tell you a little parable. I call it theology on a plane. And it comes from a sociologist of religion who visited. I used to teach on the other side of the state in a place called Westminster College. And this particular sociologist came to give us a lecture one day. And he had the interesting job and dubious honor of being President Clinton's spiritual advisor. I always wondered about that. And he happened to be a fairly conservative Baptist intellectual, but also a really good sociologist. And he talked about what it was like being a sociologist of religion on a plane. And I'll never forget this, because this has happened to me 1,000 times too. It goes like this. The person next to you asks, "So what do you do?" And you don't want to tell them. So you say something really vague like, "Well, I'm a professor." Well, you know what's coming next. What do you teach? And then you try everything. I've tried comparative religion. I've tried history of religion. I've tried religion. Nothing works. The person's eyes either glaze over in horror or they proceed to tell you the truth of religion, which, of course, just happens to reflect their particular tradition. So it's sort of a non-starter. If you're a woman, I have lots of graduate students who are female, the first question they get is, "Oh, so you want to be a nun?" So there are just no categories. Again, there are no categories. These are transferences, right? You're taking something from your past and you're applying it. This particular man had a very effective answer. He said, "Look, if I'm sitting on a plane and somebody asks me that and I want to talk, I tell them I'm a sociologist, because nobody really knows what a sociologist does. It sounds kind of cool, and so people will talk." He says, "If I'm tired and I don't feel like talking, I tell them I'm a Baptist preacher." And that pretty much ends the conversation right there. So that's my little parable. I want you to think about that. Who do you, again, we're sitting on a plane. What do we say to each other? Okay, so let me then spend the next few minutes just telling you the basics about my own life and my own perspective, because for two reasons. One, so you can know where I'm coming from, but also I think you'll find as we go on in the next few days that these questions I'm asking and these ideas I'm proposing really come out of that life, and I want you to know where they come from. I'm not an objective, walking transcendent ego. I'm an embodied person with a very tortured life, like all of you people. And so we need to know a bit about that. I grew up in Nebraska. Anybody here from Nebraska? Nobody's from Nebraska. What? Where? Oh, really? Where?
I was born in Nebraska.
Where? Oh, good for you. Okay, I like her already. I was born in a little town called Hebron, Nebraska. Population 1,800. My parents ran the True Value hardware store there for 39 years. The place was demolished in 1953 by a massive tornado. I was not alive in 1953, but so I grew up in the shadow of that tornado. I spent many evenings underneath the pool table in the basement and running to storm shelters, which for some bizarre reason were built 20 yards from the houses. So I've never figured that one out. Why you want to run through the storm to get away? I've never got that one. And so a lot of my childhood memories, believe it or not, involve the Wizard of Oz, which I watched every year in complete horror. It opens, you know, on the farm and the tornado, and you get blown away and you open. And then there's that damn witch and those monkeys. I hated those monkeys. I also used to have a dream. This was a recurring dream. This is part of my psychoanalysis. I was a little boy, and I was always being chased by monsters. And at some point, I realized, and I knew I was dreaming in the dream, by the way. It's what we call a lucid dream, where you know you're dreaming. So I knew this was a dream, but I didn't know how to stop it until I figured out how to stop it in the dream. And my secret was I would cover myself with a sheet. I don't know where I got this sheet, but it always seemed to be around. And I would tap my feet together 3 times. And I would then wake up and there was no monster. And believe it or not, I didn't realize where I got that until I was like 14 or something. I was like, oh my God, that's what Dorothy did. So, Hebron, Nebraska was a German settlement, almost all German, mostly farmers, about a third Catholic, about a third Lutheran, and a third, a little of everything else, Protestant. I think there was one Jewish man in town, no African Americans, no Asians, very, very homogenous in terms of its ethnicity. But I grew up in the Catholic third of the town. I was an athlete. I was the quarterback. I was the point guard. I was the catcher. I was sort of an all-around athlete until puberty hit. And that's when things really got rough. Basically what happened is I stopped eating. I became deeply, deeply anorexic. It's very hard being the quarterback when you don't eat. But that's what I did. And in my own mind, of course, by the way, there was no term anorexia at that point. Karen Carpenter had not yet died. This was in kind of the mid. Actually, she might have just died. This was in the mid 70s. Does anybody know when Karen died? It must have been around then. Anyway, this term was not in the culture. I quit eating because I was fasting. I became very, very pious. I was trying to be a saint, essentially. That was what was in my mind, and that's what I was going to do. And I thought that meant to fast and to be celibate, because that's what my tradition clearly told me, that if you wanted to be holy, you couldn't be sexual, and you certainly couldn't be married. And somehow my little adolescent psyche equated food and sex. It's actually an ancient equation, by the way. And so to battle my budding sexuality, I battled the food, and I didn't eat. And I think the logic somewhere in there was my body was changing. It was obviously becoming a very scary thing. And so if I didn't eat, maybe it would stop that. Maybe I would stop growing. And so I did. That's what I did. So in my own mind, I was pursuing holiness. That was not what my mom and dad saw. They were, of course, horrified, both of them, but for different reasons. And my dad happened to grow up with when they were boys, his name was A.J., and A.J. went on and became a Benedictine monk and took the name Xavier. So his name was Father Xavier, and he was a monk at a Benedictine monastery about 3 hours down the road. And he would come home to Hebron to see his elderly mother and sisters. And so my mom and dad asked me if I would talk to Father Xavier, because they were very, very concerned about me. And I was happy to do that. Father Xavier became my first spiritual director. He was my spiritual director from junior high all the way into my first or second year in college. And he basically kept me alive. And I followed Father Xavier then when I graduated into the monastic seminary. I entered a Catholic seminary that was run by this Benedictine monastery. And I went there because of Father Xavier. The monastery, though, and the seminary in some ways made matters worse because it's an ascetic, celibate community, and it confirmed my intuition that to be holy was to not have a body. And so I ate even less in the seminary, and I got even skinnier. And the monks got very concerned about me as well. The monks also were very astute psychologically. People have this wrong-headed idea, at least they did then, that when a young man entered the seminary, they locked the doors behind him and they didn't let him out until he had a collar around his neck. Actually, the opposite was true. The moment you entered the seminary, you were given a battery of psychological tests, all the standard psychological tests, and they tried everything in their power to kick you out every year. Because they were very concerned about all of the things that, of course, have transpired in the church in the last decade. They were very aware of those. And so that particular seminary was psychologically oriented. We studied Freud, we studied Jung, and there was one of the monks was a psychoanalyst trained by Bruno Bettelheim at the University of Chicago. His name was Father Basil. Father Basil was one of the most unusual human beings I've ever met. He was so conservative theologically that he would not say Mass in English. He got special permission from Rome to say Mass in Latin in the basement of the Basilica. He also ate an apple with a fork and a knife. And he taught Latin and Greek to us, and I'm not exaggerating, every other word or every other sentence either had the F word or the D word. This was the most vulgar man I have ever met in my life, and he was also the most conservative theologically, and I think that's what made him a great psychoanalyst, is he was this sort of this paradox. So I was put into analysis with Father Basil. I was obviously dying. I was having trouble walking upstairs. I was freezing every winter. When you have zero body fat, winters are very hard. And so I went into analysis. This was after so 6 years of spiritual direction, so I was already primed for this. This wasn't new in some sense. And as soon as I went into analysis with Father Basil, I began having all of these most extraordinary dreams about curvaceous women offering me banana cream pies and malt shakes and ice cream. And, of course, I felt guilty. I couldn't take the food in the dream. And Father Basil would say, "So, Jeff, what do you think of those dreams?" And I'm like, "I don't know. You're the analyst. You tell me." "No, you tell me." So we had these conversations, and I said, "Well, you know, it seems to me that there's obviously some connection between food and sex, and that all the food has milk in it." And wow, that was an insight. And so we started to talk about my mom. And it was really quite amazing. I realized that somewhere in my psyche I'd equated not just food and sex, but food, sex, and mom, which of course is why I wouldn't have sex, because that would be having sex with mom. And I couldn't do that. And once I realized that, it was like you took a dial and you just turned it, and I gained 60 pounds in about 4 months, 5 months. And I've never been anorexic since. So I could use a little anorexia right now, but it was an instant cure, it was an instant healing, and it happened because, and this is the key point, I realized that my unconscious was controlling my conscious behavior, and that it was doing it through religious ideas, And that the religious ideas really weren't just about religion. They were really about sex and family and mom and dad and food and all of these other things. And that was a very, very powerful insight. Because it gave me a way of course, reading other people's religious behaviors and ideas that were all around me. This was a community of about 80 young men, all of whom were claiming they were going to be celibate, which is a very strange thing to claim when you're 18 or 19. So I began, that was sort of my entry point into the study of religion, as it were. And then something else happened which was very, very powerful. One of my best friends, his name was John. John was one of these individuals whom just seems to be out of step with things. He'd trip walking upstairs. He'd get into minor car accidents. One day we were sitting on the front steps of the basilica, and John was telling me about how a bird flew over earlier that morning and shat on him from the sky. It shat on. Great aim. And as he was telling me this, a bird nest fell out of the bell tower and landed on his head. I was like, John, man, something's going on here. This was like my two foxes, only it was negative, right? Well, John tried to kill himself a few months later. He swallowed a whole bottle of sleeping pills, and they found him snoring in a chapel at a local college. That's how they found him. He recovered. He came back. I said, John, why did you do that? And he said, I did it because I'm gay. And by the way, almost everyone here is gay. And when he said that, it was like the John Cleese moment. You know, it was like, oh my God, you're right. I happened to be straight and naive, and so I didn't know those things. But it made me realize that our religious faith had almost killed this human being because he couldn't put together his being, which was very, very gay, and his faith, which was very, very homophobic, frankly. And so he tried to remove the offending party, which, of course, was himself. And that's why he tried that. He was not the only one. In my 4 years there, three of these guys tried to kill themselves, and two succeeded. One monk hung himself in the barn. Another young seminarian blew his head out with a pistol, and John swallowed the sleeping pills. And that, I think, affected me deeply as well. I continued to think about all these things there, and I came to the realization that the Catholic seminary was essentially a gay community. Not active. These men were not acting on it. They were celibate. But that their spirituality was very much a sublimated kind of homoerotic spirituality. They were deeply in love with a male god whose flesh and fluids they ate every day. They had no desire for women. And so celibacy made perfect sense to them. And I didn't fit in to their friendships, to their spiritual cliques, to really anything. And so I decided that I needed to leave. So I graduated with a BA there, and I left that dream, really, of a religious life in the church. And I went to graduate school, which is what many people in my situation happen to do. You want to stay close to the traditions, but you can't be in the tradition. And so you figure out how to do that. That, as you might well imagine, changed me dramatically about how I think about things. I didn't leave the seminary or because I was angry or because I didn't believe anymore or something. I left because I simply didn't fit in and couldn't fit in. And so I continue to think about that. I went to the University of Chicago. I'm almost done here. I went to the University of Chicago where I did a PhD in something called the history of religions, which most people would understand as comparative religion. It was founded by a Romanian scholar named Mircea Eliade in 1961-62. Eliade died the year I got there. I was trained by his successor, a woman named Wendy Doniger. Eliade, of course, was very close to Carl Jung, attended the Uranus lectures in Switzerland. So we all read Jung, we all read Eliade, we all were sort of trained in that tradition. And I spent 8 years there, one of which I lived in Calcutta, and wrote my first, I wrote my dissertation and my first book on a famous Hindu saint named Ramakrishna. Ironically, I was attracted to Hinduism because I was looking for a goddess. My spiritual life was deeply erotic at that point, and I simply couldn't find an object, a religious object in Catholicism. There are no divine females with whom a male mystic can unite in Roman Catholicism. Everybody always says, well, what about the Virgin Mary? I'm like, dude, she's your mother. Right? So that's the problem. There are no goddesses. God is male. Regardless of what anybody says, God is male in Catholicism. And that's why the mysticisms are all homoerotic for men. And so I was attracted to tantric forms of Hinduism because I wanted a goddess. And I found one in this goddess named Kali. And I wrote a strange pick for a goddess, obviously, but powerful too. And Ramakrishna, it turns out, and this is where it gets very ironic, Ramakrishna, it turns out, was a homoerotic mystic in a heterosexual world. And it's very clear in the Bengali. I showed this, I think, very convincingly. And that first book won a lot of fans in the academy, but also did not go over well in India. There were two band movements, national organized band movements, one in 96, one in 2001. I was put on the list for their CBI, which is our CIA. The book was debated in Parliament. You can't buy it in India. It's not technically banned because the motions all failed in Parliament, but it's confiscated at the borders probably to this day. And so I just got going. I spent 10 years studying Bengali and Sanskrit, and I had to give that all up because I couldn't go to India. It simply would not have been safe. So I wrote, my next book was called Roads of Excess, Palaces of Wisdom, and it was on the mystical experiences of scholars of mysticism. And I included in that book my journal entries in which I talked about my own experiences, both in the Catholic seminary and living in India. And I sort of developed this idea of the homoerotic structure of male mystical traditions. After that, it was a book called The Serpent's Gift. I'm telling you all this, by the way, so you'll go on Amazon tonight and buy all these books. The Serpent's Gift was a book about the study of religion as a form of modern Gnosticism. I took up the telling of the Adam and Eve story that the Gnostics told. For the early Christian Gnostics, the hero of that story is obviously the snake. It's really clear. He does exactly what he says he's going to do. He gives this beautiful young couple this knowledge, and they awaken to what? Their genitals. It's the first thing. They realize that they're naked. So there's something about the fruit that has to do with sexuality, and if they can eat the second fruit, they'll become immortal, like God. And God agrees with all this, so he kicks them out of the garden. He's obviously the bad guy in this story. And so I took this parable and I said, well, you know, that's exactly what it's like studying religion. That's what a college classroom is like. The professor's the snake. He or she's offering this fruit to these beautiful young couples. And if they take it, they're never the same again. And I really believe that's what happens. And so that's what that book is about. The fourth book was the Esalen book, which we'll talk about tomorrow. And the fifth book is the book on the paranormal called Authors of the Impossible, which we'll talk about on Monday. I apologize if I have spoken too long or too much about myself. I really wanted you to know that professors or people like me are not eggheads in ivory towers. We do what we do because we are seekers like you, because we've suffered because of the religions. We still want to be religious. And we're trying to figure out how. We're essentially doing what you're doing. We're trying to find a story, a way of being religious that's adequate to our own time and place. My own feeling about this is that we're really not working for us. We're working for our children and our children's children. I will certainly never live to see a religious community that can live up to the most basic standards of a secular institution like the university. No good university will discriminate on the basis of sex, religion, or sexual orientation. Every major religious tradition I know discriminates on all three. So I hope and I pray for the day when the religions will live up to those seemingly secular values. I also hope to hear from you about your own thoughts and answers to these questions. And I look forward to our conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
The next part is to look at your name tag, and it will tell you the group you have signed up for. And what we will do is the group leaders will stand, and after they stand, at the finish of the group leader standing, you will follow your group leader to the small cafeteria where you will get acquainted, and the group leader will tell you something about what is going to happen in your session, and you will get acquainted with each other. So we have for group one, yeah.
Those of you who signed up for Patty DeLosa's group will have to choose another group because Patty is ill and cannot be with us this weekend. So if you are in group three, you will need to choose another group from among the group leaders who are here. And some of you may have indicated a second choice that you want to follow, or you make a decision on the spot.
Okay, Walter Brown, Group 1, Jung and Quakerism. Bonnie Damron, Dream Your Dreams, Group 2. Then we have Group 3 is canceled. All right, so Group 3 is canceled, and you need to choose another group. 4 is Sandra Fox. Another fox, creating mandalas. Oh, Sandra Fox is canceled also? All right. Dana Gaynor for Massive Life, Group 5. Mary Hopkins, Before We Dream, Potential Therapeutic Uses of Liminal States. That one is group six. Group seven, beginning your own red book, Lorraine Kraling. Group eight, Carol Mac. She's what? Carol Mac. We're going to have to do a lot of changing around. Oh, group three is the only one changing. Beth Perry, Letting Go and Paying Attention, The Wisdom of Tai Chi. Group 10, Ruth Reagan, Forgiveness and Spiritual Practice. Oh, I'm sorry, Sue Reagan. Okay. And then we have of finding your inner democracy, finding an inner democracy of spirit through journaling, Ruth of Dorothy Reichert. I need another sheet. That's what I need here. Okay. Doris Tennyson is canceled. And we have Doing Nothing Creatively. Peggy Walbridge. All right. So you have to follow one of these leaders into the small dining room. Okay, bye-bye.